You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Green Left Weekly Radio.
There's one newspaper that is independent of powerful capitalist interests, and that is Green Left Weekly.
It's the people's voice, committed to human and civil rights, ecological sustainability, democracy and equality. It presents ideas that the mainstream media won't.
Green Left is a leading source of local, national and international news with analysis, discussion and debate to strengthen the anti-capitalist movement.
It helps expose the lies of the capitalist press and puts the voices of the marginalised and the oppressed at the centre of fighting for a better world and helps us understand the political developments unfolding around us.
Good morning, listeners. You are listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR, 855 AM on your dial, or maybe you are streaming live from 3cr.org.au or listening back to our podcast. Wherever you are, thank you for joining us today. And for your presenters today, you're joined by myself, Jacob Antwerfer, who's going to be one of your co-presenters today, and I'm very happy to be joined by
Stephanie. Good morning, listeners. And before we go any further, we'll just do an acknowledgement of country. So 3CR and Green Left recognise that this show is being broadcast from the land of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people, the original rightful sovereign owners, storytellers and caretakers of this land. Australia was founded on genocide and dispossession of the first people, and we recognise that this genocide is ongoing. As socialists, we pledge to actively support decolonisation. We stand with all the first peoples of the world in their struggle for justice and land rights.
Okay, so just to tell you what we have coming up for our program before we go into some news stories from the past week. We have a pre-recorded interview with Bhaskar Sankara from the United States, and he was the founding editor of Jacobin. He's currently one of the editors for The Nation, and he was just recently in Australia as part of a Search Foundation sponsored tour where he was very much talking about the prospects of building socialism and the socialist movement in the United States. The last time that he visited was in 2018, and I'm pretty sure we might have played an interview that we did with him for Green Left. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to playing that interview. So I recorded that interview with him on Monday. So, yeah, hope listeners enjoy. And currently it is also available to listen back to on the Green Left website. Then we're going to be speaking to Karen Brown. And Karen Brown is a public housing tenant who lives in Waterloo in New South Wales, one of the public housing estates that's kind of targeted for demolition in New South Wales, and there's been a very much an ongoing kind of campaign and struggle, occupation, I'm looking forward to hearing from Karen Brown. Then we're going to be speaking to a community member called Jake Delphin, who is part of organising a protest against, you know, the construction of a large data centre in Melbourne's West. Although I think there's a number of data centres being kind of planned, and I think this will be probably a topic that we'll be covering for future programs from different angles, because very much these data centres are all very much kind of part of, you know, the big artificial intelligence boom. And, you know, I'll probably say that this program and Green Left is very much taking a very critical perspective of, you know, the push for this for generative artificial intelligence. And I imagine a lot of other 3CR programs is taking a similar position. So, yeah, quite a packed program this week. And I guess we can go on to a bit of a headline news story. Probably one story I want to kind of highlight is, you know, I guess as 3CR, as community radio, I guess I sort of feel the need to to criticise other prominent sort of journalists and presenters when, like in terms of the mainstream, in this case, the case of the ABC radio host Charlie Pickering. And this is reading from an article published by Deep Cut News, where essentially Charlie Pickering was interviewed by the far-right media outlet Rebel News, and this was kind of published. Now, there's been this, you know, very terrible kind of right-wing backlash against sexual assault survivor advocate Grace Tame, who just recently, you know, has produced a 4-episode podcast series titled Autistic AF. I mean, people could probably figure out the meaning of those two letters with Grace Tame. You know, basically it's like a podcast essentially, you know, promoting Grace Tame's lived experience of neurodiversity and autism, you know, completely not related to politics at all. Yet that has actually caused the ire of the right. So the right have, including the Liberal Party, have gone on and went on the attack against the ABC for, you know, how dare they hire Grace Tame to produce this podcast. And, you know, the reality is they are criticising Grace Tame because Grace Tame has spoken up for Palestine, and she spoke consistently up for a Palestine rally. Now, I was very disappointed with this interview, with Charlie Pickering doing an interview with a far-right outfit like Avi Yemini. And he basically said that he was kind of asked a question about Grace Tame's hiring, and then he said, oh, he believed Grace Tame's hiring was problematic, and basically made this argument that, you know, as you would understand, as a Jewish Australian, there is a complete misunderstanding of a lot of the words that are said and what the true meaning of them are, and a lot of people are using words and phrases that have meaning well beyond what they think they do, Pickering said. And I think you could argue that a lot of people that jump on protest bandwagons are ignorant a lot of the time. So, you know, essentially, you know, he, as an AB, as someone who works for the ABC, Charlie, that is, he essentially was willing to go be platformed by a far-right provocateur, in this case, Avi Yemini, and in this case, essentially undermining the hiring of Grace Tame and actually criticising her publicly. And also, especially, I also think, you know, Charlie has sort of said this in a way that he thinks is quite intelligent, but I think it's very much just apologism for Zionism. Now, it's not obviously not like, I wouldn't say that this is like blatantly sort of like, you know, it's not like this is not on the level of like other kind of Zionists. Like, I don't think that, you know, Charlie Pickering is necessarily, you know, saying anything that I would sort of classify as genocidal in a sense, but he is giving cover for a sort of almost a kind of a Zionist sort of argument that, oh, there's actually something inherently problematic about saying globalize the intifada.
And just like, well, it's just sort of a rhetoric that legitimizes Israel's occupation, which is unlawful. You know, even in our like sort of westernized sense of morality, like the UN still feels it's unlawful as well, and they've said as much. And it's just, it's pretty, it's interesting that he can hold that perspective and then at the same time be, interviewing people like Avi, and it does feel a little bit hypocritical.
I have actually kind of read reports that so Charlie Pickering has obviously been out of fire because obviously he's quite a prominent media personality. He does the weekly kind of which is sort of this sort of comedy sort of show on the ABC. And he's ultimately come on the defense and sort of said, oh, you know, basically along the lines of saying something that, you know, his words have been taken out of context and, you know, and that, you know, he has lots of respect for Grace Tame. I mean, I just think that's a bit of much. Like, I think the reality is you willingly appeared on a far-right program that was actually undermining, like, it was, like, what Avi Yemini was trying to do. This, I think this, he was Harvey Yemeni was deliberately trying to undermine the ABC, which is Charlie Pickering's employer. I just don't think, like, the fact that you appeared on that show shows terrible judgment. I mean, he is entitled to his views, and I'm willing to say that I think his views on this question are wrong. Yeah. But I just think it shows absolutely poor judgment for someone with such a prominent sort of platform within the ABC. He's probably one of the more prominent people within the ABC to just to be able to just say that even against his own employer. I just think it's ridiculous.
Yeah, but we've had some other spicy news this week, haven't we, Jacob? Which, I mean, it probably is in many ways maybe a bit more concerning than Charlie Pickering's comments. Although, I am glad that he seems to have backed down on what he said, I think. But just around, unfortunately, abortion rights again are under attack. Did you want to share with listeners a bit more about?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So just to let listeners know, reading from an article that we published on Green Left, and this was published by Pip Hinman at the start of the month, and there has been some more developments since then.
Yes.
But in the context of this growing rise of One Nation, though One Nation is enjoying, I think, like 30% in the polls, and there's also this context where I think Pauline Hanson has sort of outpolled Albanese in terms of preferred prime minister. Now, essentially, anti-abortion MPs are coordinating their attacks on hard-won reproductive healthcare rights in free states. So essentially, the new South Australian elected representative for the Legislative Council for Pauline Hanson's One Nation Party is expected to reintroduce a bill to restrict abortion rights on June 17th. Sarah Game wants to restrict abortion access from 24 weeks and 6 days. South Australia allows abortion after 23 weeks with the approval of two doctors, where continuing the pregnancy would pose a significant risk to the physical or mental health of the pregnant person. And, of course, Game's bill would remove serious fetal abnormalities as a valid reason for accessing a late-term abortion and only allow it to be legal when necessary to save the life of the mother. Then you're also having some attacks in New South Wales with New South Wales Libertarian MP. Well, he says he's a Libertarian. I mean, I thought Libertarians were for all for individual rights. John Roddick wants to criminalise abortion with doctors, criminalise doctors with fines of up to $22,000 and 5 years prison under the guise of stopping sex selective abortions in his abortion law reform amendment, sex selection prohibition bill.
Yeah.
To be honest, I think one of the kind of motivations of this bill, I think, relies on a bit of a kind of myth about abortion. Mm-hmm. Like, often there's a kind of argument against abortion that, women just willingly abort if they don't get the right gender for their child, when it's just not, like, there's no evidence that this is actually true.
No.
There's also a racist angle to this, where they're basically trying to say that this is being sought by women from particular ethnic or cultural backgrounds, which is, very much linking into this whole racist and anti-immigration rhetoric. And then the next state is in Queensland. Katter's Australia Party is moving a disallowance procedural motion in Parliament that allows a member to debate a regulation to block nurses and midwives from prescribing MS two-step and oral medication for early medical pregnancy termination. So, if this was successful, it will remove nurses and midwives' ability to prescribe the medication, creating serious barriers for women to access reproductive health care, particularly in regional and remote areas.
Yeah.
We have to be aware of this. One thing to note, I mean, these bills, I think, at this point are not likely to pass, because as far as I know, in all instances, the state Labor governments, there's a state Liberal Party in Queensland, but in both cases, the state governments, the parties that run the state governments are not necessarily coming out in support of these bills. But, I mean, I do think this is something we should be aware of, we should be mobilising against, and we should be speaking out against, especially since, you know, One Nation is growing in the polls. The right could make a massive ascendancy in the upcoming election. So, yeah.
100%. Yeah. It's something all of us on the left need to keep an eye on. And even people not on the left, but just support, you know, a woman's right to choose. Not just women, but people with uteruses' right to choose. Yeah, it's a really important reproductive right.
Yeah, and yeah, you can read more by going on the pages of Green Left. And it's the article titled Anti-Abortion MPs Collaborate to Remove Hard-Won Reproductive Rights.
Yeah, it's a really detailed article, that one. It's good.
Okay, So I'm just going to go play a quick announcement. And actually, maybe we'll go play a song and then go into our first pre-recorded interview for the program. You're listening to Green Left Radio.
Keffiyehs are Palestinian scarves, and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people. From the traditional black and white keffiyeh to an array of modern designs, explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. Wear your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to keffiyehs.org.au. That's keffiyehs.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
Okay, you're listening to Green Left Radio, and we're going to play a pre-recorded interview with Bhaskar Sankara. But like I thought before we start that we'll play a song. So I was going to play a track from Boards of Canada, The Word Becomes Flesh, and this is from their new album that just got released in the past month, titled Inferno. So I hope listeners enjoy.
Thank you.
Okay, that was The Words Become Flesh by Boards of Canada. Now I'll go into the interview, the pre-recorded interview that I did with Bhaskar Sankara. And this is Bashir was the founding editor of Jacobin. I think he's currently the president of the progressive newspaper The Nation. And yeah, he was just at an Australian tour that was funded by the Search Foundation. So yeah, I hope listeners enjoy this interview.
My name is Jacob Andrafa, and I'm part of Green Left. We acknowledge that this is being recorded on stolen land, the land of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung of the Kulin Nation, always was and always will be Aboriginal land. So for our program today, we are actually joined today by Bhaskar Sankara, who is currently on tour here in Australia. Bhaskar is the founding editor of Jacobin. He is the author of the Socialist Manifesto and president of the American progressive journal The Nation. He last visited Australia in 2018 and has very much been a regular kind of commentator on socialist politics in the United States. So yeah, it's good to have you with us today, Bhaskar.
Thanks for having me. It's nice to see you again.
So I guess the kind of first question we wanted to ask for this interview is, what is your estimate of the pushback against Trump and the rise of the populist right in the US, particularly looking at the No Kings protests, which I think have actually been quite inspiring, kind of looking from afar, the fact that we have these sort of nation sort of wide protests against the current sitting president, which has obviously been a lot of scope for mobilization. And then, of course, we've also seen the anti-ICE protests as well, which has kind of intersected with that. And I guess, yeah, what are your kind of comments on that?
Yeah, I think Trump right now is historically unpopular. His approval rating is around 39%, and that's in a country that's polarized, that is a two-party system. So 39% is really close to the floor of what you can imagine a major party incumbent would be at. And things really started to turn against Trump with the anti-ICE mobilization and with the administration forced to retreat in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And I think for that, that's a victory that the far left deserves direct credit for. Those protests came from immigrant right groups, came from the wellspring of anarchist, communist, socialist organizing in the Twin Cities, and it was incredibly effective. It even won over some Trump voters who thought that what was happening had crossed certain lines that they couldn't abide. Beyond that, there's a center-left resistance to Trump that incorporates elements of the far left. I think the No Kings protests came from Indivisible. It's been built by lists that came from around the Democratic Party and from other center-left infrastructure. Socialist arguments and participation is very much welcome there. We get a strong response participating in the No Kings protests as open socialists. But I think the start of things turning for Trump was the backlash in the Twin Cities, the anti-ICE protests. Then after that, of course, he's alienated even portions of his younger supporters with his support for Israeli genocide. But more importantly than that, the Iran war and the backlash that he's feeling from some of his base, largely on very economic grounds of gas prices are higher and things are getting better and we are promised an end to forever wars. He still has, the majority of his base, but in such a polarized country, losing a few percentage points actually means you're in trouble.
Mm. And that following on, I guess, from that, I mean, what do you think about the kind of impact of Israel's genocide in Gaza? Because one of the things that we have noticed in Australia here is that it's clearly influenced a whole new generation of people into progressive politics, kind of a bit like what the Vietnam War movement did last century. What can you comment on that?
Well, I think that the basis here is different The anti-genocide movement, the Palestine Solidarity Movement, is very different, at least in the U.S. context, compared to our Vietnam movement. I think in part because of the scale of U.S. casualties in Vietnam and the scale of the amount of people that were deployed and maimed and injured or drafted for that conflict led to a real working class GI movement and a movement against the draft that took on a dynamic in which it was more disruptive and captured a wider part of the social base. I would imagine that in Australia, you obviously didn't have the equivalent of that, in part because the scale of Australian participation in the Vietnam movement was the Vietnam War was more limited. Now, I think that the Palestine Solidarity Movement has been highly effective at mobilizing young people. A lot of it is very much not only a campus-based movement, but a movement in which the sentiments of young people have swung away from Israel and towards struggling for some sort of just resolution in Palestine. But it does very much seem to be a movement that's limited to the young, and particularly a movement that has shaped the Democratic Party's perception of Israel. The majority of Democrats now oppose Israel, feel more solidarity with Palestinians than they do with Israelis. And this is a major swing, and this has the Israel lobby in the United States extremely, extremely nervous. But it does seem to be very much a youth-based politicization.
Yeah. Well, that kind of flows into, I think, the next kind of question, especially in terms of the anti-genocide kind of movement. What do you think about, and this can be more broadly to any kind of social struggle that's happening in the United States right now, you know, are the traditional institutional supports for the left, such as trade unions, playing a good or decisive role in any social movement in the United States? What are your kind of comments on that?
The trade union movement in the United States is still quite weak. We have fairly high levels of public sector union density, around 33%, but our private sector union density is down to 6%. More and more of what remains of the labor movement, I would say, is under left leadership, including rank and file caucuses that have very engaged members. But on the whole, unions are not playing a decisive role at the moment. I think there was a lot of energy towards the tail end of the Biden administration towards a kind of labor-left populism that involved, for the U.S. context, fairly large-scale strikes in the automotive industry. There were certain Teamster locals that went on strike. There was a wave previous to that of teacher strikes, including in quote-unquote red states, you know, Republican-run states. I think that tide has largely fallen in part because the organizing climate is so much worse under Trump, particularly because labor relations in the U.S. is mediated through a National Labor Relations Board, which went from being relatively, actually quite pro-labor under Joe Biden to now being very anti-labor under Trump. And for lots of reasons, some of them rational, union bureaucrats are very, and members themselves are very wary of risking their strike funds and, you know, investing in organizing. I would argue, though, that it's now or never for labor. Labor is in secular decline in the U.S. and across the advanced capitalist world, but they also are sitting on a lot of assets. Now is the time to invest in organizing. Now is the time to take risks. Now is the time to figure out how to circumvent labor law. And it's now or never. There is one leader, Sean Fain, one mainstream labor leader, who has shown a willingness to think outside the box. He is calling for a general strike on May 1, 2028. U.S. labor law, I believe, like Australian labor law, bans secondary or solidarity strikes. So the way that he's proposing unions go about this is timing up their contracts to expire in the spring of 2028, which will make it legal for them to strike. I would argue that, of course, that's a great idea, but unions in general need to find ways to circumvent labor law and, you know, figure out ways to disrupt production, because that's the only way they'll ever exert any sort of leverage. So labor is generally a force for progress in the U.S., but it's not exerting its full muscle at the national stage at the moment.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that. I mean, one thing just to comment on that, I mean, I did notice looking from afar in the United States that there were actually some notable May 1st mobilizations that happened on that happened this year. Not that they were that significant necessarily, but the fact that there was some kind of national mobilization called for May 1st that was sort of around the No Kings and anti-ICE sort of campaign, I think was, you know, probably a bit different from even, say, Australia, where we didn't have any meaningful national mobilizations on May 1st apart from the usual Queensland sort of protests.
Yeah, the way that I would put it is that the U.S. is a country in which the left is somewhat in ascent, and even parts of the labor movement are in ascent, but we are starting from such a low base. And Australia is maybe a country where you're in decline slightly from your previous base, and maybe we're meeting somewhere in the middle. But that doesn't mean either of us has cause to be too pleased with our overall strength and our depth of our connection with a working class base.
Yeah. And so that gets into the next kind of important question. I mean, what, I guess, your comments on some of the, you know, civic openings for, I guess, building a socialist movement in the United States, specifically drawing on the experience of the Democratic Socialist America. And I guess, I mean, also, given that you're also in here in Australia, I mean, what lessons do you think this offers kind of internationally for the left?
Yeah, well, I think in the United States, there's really only one socialist organization of note, which is the Democratic Socialists of America. I mean, I should say the Party for Socialism and Liberation plays a productive role in our anti-war movement, and actually through its various groups plays a role with mobilization. So that is unfair. There's also the Party for Socialism and Liberation, which has kind of a Marxite background, but I think plays a productive role in anti-war protests and also in Cuba solidarity and other things that they deserve credit for. But in general, the Democratic Socialists of America is really the only game in town if you're on the far left in the U.S. We have over 100,000 active members at the moment. Obviously, we have some prominent electoral figures, including Zoran Mamdani, who wasn't just a paper BSA member the way Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez is, or Rashida Tlaib, or other people are. He actually was heavily involved at the level of being a cadre in DSA organizing in New York City before becoming a state assemblyman, and is quite close to the organization, understands its politics, has participated in our political education, and kind of his presence has really allowed DSA in New York City to grow and expand. I wouldn't be surprised if at the end of the year we're at around 17,000 members in New York City alone, you know, the city proper, not the metropolitan area, which only has around 8.5 million people. So, you know, quite significant in terms of building a base in one city. Obviously, the DSA is largely a youth-driven organization. By youth, I mean that in the broad sense of people from 18 to 40 or something like that. And to the extent it has a working class base, it's largely workers in white collar sectors. So teachers and nurses and groups like that. We have an extensive program of industrialization, we call it salting, in which DSA cadre will often take jobs in industries like in, transport or warehouses or teaching or nursing or other sort of things to both because they're often good jobs in expanding sectors, but also to play an active role organizing. So I think DSA is doing a lot of the right things, but the scale of our adversary and the scale of capitalist power in the U.S. is really immense. So we really shouldn't be complacent, about things.
Yeah. And I guess maybe going into a kind of final kind of comments, I guess what do you kind of think is kind of like, you know, looking at the kind of the trajectory of the kind of Trump administration, what are some of your comments, I guess, on the future of, you know, struggles in the United States, especially, I guess, the future of the Democrats?
Yeah, I think globally we need to be in organizations on the socialist left that actually advocate for socialism. And there's different routes to that. In the U.S., we have a very unusual political system. We have something closer to a no-party system than a two-party system. In many ways, the Democratic Socialist America is the only political party in the United States, in a sense, in that it actually has a program. It actually has membership democracy. It actually has a dues-paying membership. The Democrats have never expelled anyone in the modern history of the Democratic Party, not a single person. The Republican Party has never expelled anyone in the modern history of the Republican Party. I could today go to the state in the U.S., not the Republican Party, but the state, and register as a Republican, and I'd be entitled with the same vote as Donald Trump to vote in Republican Party primaries. So it's a very unusual political system. But I think one thing the DSA has, it has like a program built around socialism that's cohering at least an activist layer to build socialism. Our challenge to defeat Trump is to build also a workers' movement and a working class layer of militants, then eventually to merge the two together, right, to form kind of a socialist workers' movement. But fundamentally, our challenge is even DSA is kind of stuck between the politics of opposition and the politics of governance. The route of governance seems to lead to a social democratic dead end. The route of kind of like isolation from governance seems to lead to the dead end of kind of sectarian, politics. So we really need kind of a bridge in between kind of a mass socialist politics willing to pursue, to talk openly about socialism as our goal and to try to win a program, not just to stably administer the capital state, but to transition to something else, to transition to a socialism. And obviously, I think we're a generation of organizing removed from there, but that's a horizon we need to keep alive. Otherwise, we'll just be caught in this endless cycle of defensively fighting against right populism, ultimately preferring, rightly, center-left technocratic governance to right populist governance, but not getting any closer to socialism. And I think actually further seeing the social basis of socialism, the social base of the workers' movement that we want to politicize and radicalize, further erode. And that's the central challenge that we face in the U.S. And obviously, I think we face that everywhere across the advanced capitalist world.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. I mean, I think this has been a very informative kind of interview, and it's great to kind of hear your kind of report back on, I think, what's happening in the United States.
Thanks for having me.
All right. You're just listening to an interview with Bashar Sankara, and yeah, I hope listeners enjoyed that interview. You can listen back to the interview by going on the Green Left website at greenleft.org.au. And yeah, I thought it was actually quite an informative interview. It was good to sort of get his sort of take on the US political situation from someone who's there on the ground. And I also attended his presentation on Monday at the Trades Hall, and I thought it was quite good as well. Steph, do you have any kind of quick news stories you wanted to kind of share in between?
This has just come up in the feed, but there's been there's been some really severe floods in the Northern Territory, and I'm just sort of reading how, now I'm probably going to stumble over the pronunciation, but Niue leaders, so our First Nations community, are returning home to their town after being in evacuation centres for 3 months, and it's just, quite devastating. For them, their homes, some homes have been fixed, but others have not. And there's just a lot of damage and, really quite sad and awful. And I mean, there's so many aspects to this story, but of course, colonisation and the poverty that and lack of, funding in First Nations communities. And then there's also the, climate change aspect that makes these events much more common now and going into the future. So it's quite sad, but just solidarity to that community.
Yeah, I'd like to give my solidarity to, everyone who's sort of been impacted by the climate crisis. Because the reality is, the nature of the climate crisis is not going to be experienced equally. And you know, it's always going to be the most marginalized groups that are going to experience the impacts of the climate crisis,
yeah.
especially within the global south, but even within global north countries, it's going yeah. to be the most marginalized groups that yeah. will disproportionately experience yeah. the climate
yeah.
crisis.
And people of color, and we've seen that time and time again with, yeah, all kinds of natural disasters, but yeah, flooding's no exception. Like, you think about the impacts of Hurricane Katrina and how that impacted, yeah, predominantly black communities, and yeah, and now here we've got in our own nation, First Nations people bearing the brunt once again. So yeah, very sad.
Okay, so I'll play a quick announcement. You're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM.
The media in this country, we as Indigenous people know, have censored our right of telling the truth, and the truth is what this country is most fearful of, in particular Indigenous truths. Until history is told by the vanquished lens, which is our people telling our story our way, and have the right to be able to incorporate that into a system of learning, well, people are always going to be denied that truth by deceit and lies. When you look at the type of psychological warfare, spiritual warfare that Aboriginal people are caught in, it's not just in the sense of military when they talk about weapons of mass destruction, but you're right, it's in terms of the media, and the industry of media is a warfare against our people, and so is religion, I believe, in the Western sense. They're all weapons of mass destruction against our people.
We need to keep radical voices on air. Subscribe now.
Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 9419 8377.
Because the Palestinian fight isn't just the Palestinians' fight, it's all our fight, because it's a fight not just about land, it's about a fight for freedom.
Everybody should be standing here today saying, Free Palestine.
Solidarity with our Palestinian brothers and sisters on behalf of the Gumbanja Nation, my people who've never ceded their sovereignty.
We should be recognising Palestine as a state and recognising the rights of Palestinians.
3CR, stay tuned, stay radical.
All right, you're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM, and we're very happy to be joined today by Karen Brown, who is a resident at Waterloo and an activist with Action for Public Housing in Sydney. And she is currently part of an ongoing occupation of the Waterloo public housing estates against demolition, which are stated for demolition by the state Labor government. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning.
Can you give us a bit of a, just for our listeners, especially some of our listeners are quite familiar with public housing campaigning, and a lot of us are involved in the campaign to save public housing in Victoria. What can you tell us about a bit of the political background to the attempted demolition of the Waterloo public housing estate by the state Labor government?
Well, OK, it started about 10 years ago, or 11 years ago, in fact, by the Liberal state government. They had a program called Communities Plus. It's basically, they don't want to pay for public housing. They want public housing to pay for itself, which doesn't work, really. Doesn't work with hospitals, transport, schools, etc. So their idea was called Communities Plus, where they said we need social mix, okay? The ideal mix is 30% public housing and the rest market housing. Because that makes, it a better environment for the people in public housing. They can aspire, they can see their neighbours and aspire to be like them, or some rubbish like that. In fact, they say this is world's best practice, this 30% share of public housing. In fact, my research shows that that is really related to real estate values. So if you get more than 30% public housing in the area, then the prices of real estate drop surrounding it, which is good news for the homeowners who live in Waterloo now because they could afford to buy here, and there are plenty. Then along comes State Labor. While they were in opposition, they said, oh, this is terrible, this is disgraceful, this is social cleansing, which is correct. But once they got elected in 2023, they've changed their mind and said, oh, no, we're going to do it anyway. But look how great we are. We're going to add 20% of affordable housing. So that's kind of where we're at now. It's still selling off public land. And, well, they say we're going to own the land, but it's useless if it's got, you know, million-dollar apartments on it. So they're going ahead with dislocating currently 750 households from Waterloo from perfectly good buildings which are going to be demolished, and those 750 households will go to the front of the waiting list for public housing, which is about 65,000 at the moment.
Yeah. Oh, Karen, I'm just hearing what you're saying, and just unfortunately so much of that is exactly what's also happening in Victoria, and it's heartbreaking to hear 750 families to be affected. And yeah, and that makes the action that you've been taking to try and save the Waterloo public housing just so important. And can you tell us a bit about the occupation, if that's okay? I'm so intrigued what you're up to with that.
Yes, all right. So on Sunday the 24th, we had a rally in Redfern and marched down to Waterloo to where some of the already vacant properties are. We had a barbecue there and put up some tents, and the idea was really to stay one night just to make a point.
Yeah.
And then in the morning, these people came and started putting fences up around the housing, and we're like, you can't do that. People still live in there.
Oh, my goodness.
Which they do.
Yeah.
So we kind of just got in the way of them and stopped them putting fences up, and the police came. And luckily we had Jenny Leong, a Greens Member of Parliament, who happened to be there, who, well, we called her, she came and she spoke to the police and demolition workers, I don't know, they're just putting up the fences. So we thought we should stay and stop them putting up the fences, so we're still there.
Yeah, oh, that's incredible. It's so organic, but sounded like that's what's needed at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, look, we've tried the, you know,
try playing nice.
Exactly. Yes, yeah. We've tried other means to stop this, like, you know, common sense, housing crisis, please don't demolish housing.
Yeah, you would think that, yeah.
Yeah. So going into the kind of next kind of question is that, you know, the state housing minister is trying to make out that, you know, this whole kind of protest is misguided. They very much tried to say this argument that the Waterloo community is not functional. And but also I think the Labor government has also, I mean, they've made a similar argument in Victoria as well, but they're sort of trying to make out that the destruction of the public housing is necessary because we need to build new houses, etc. You know, these houses are not functional and so on. You know, how do you kind of respond to these kind of smears from the Labor government, who is trying to basically say that you're protesting essentially for nothing?
Well, look, that was pretty insulting of her to say that the community is not functional. It is functional. Perhaps sections of it aren't, but the solution to that is a people solution, not a building solution. And as for delivering more public housing, well, okay, eventually if they go ahead with their entire plan, there'll be 200, maybe 300 more public housing units than there are already, but that will be years away.
Mm.
And it will be mostly taken up by people who are getting displaced from other public housing, so it's not going to help anyone on the waiting list. In the meantime, they've actually done an audit of government-owned land around Sydney to see where they could build housing. And that's what they're planning to do, but none of it, none at all, is public housing. It's all been given to developers with maybe a fraction of affordable housing, which is, you know, when they say affordable, and when they say who that's for, they usually say teachers and nurses, for example. These are university-educated professionals. So if they can't afford housing, there's something really wrong, or maybe they just need to be paid more. But they're also, like, to say there's essential workers and other workers is a bit ridiculous anyway, because basically all workers make the city function.
Yeah, the comments about not a functional community. I mean, that's just so, it's classist. It's awful. Like, just because,
it is.
Yeah, I mean, imagine there's like really diverse groups of people living there, but, you know, and there's still people. Like, what a way to dehumanize people as well. And everyone deserves a home. Everyone has a right to housing. So it's just, it's completely unacceptable. Yeah.
Everyone does have a right to housing, but it seems that governments all over Australia think that the right to accumulate wealth is more important than the right to housing.
Yes, yeah, it's a bit of a theme going on, isn't there, Karen? Okay, what are the demands of the campaign and the ongoing occupation?
Stop the demolition, refurbish those existing housing, because they are a bit old, but there's nothing wrong with them. They're double brick, solid as. So we want them refurbished. People can move into them. And build more housing. If you want to demolish this in 30 years or something, make sure there's more housing already for people to move into.
Yeah.
Because the idea that there's 750 vacant properties is a bit disturbing anyway, but that just isn't.
Yeah. No, exactly, yeah. And we all know, most of the residents of public housing who have been evicted, where they actually end up, and it's dire. I'm so grateful for the work that you're doing, Karen, and, you know, all of us are at Green Left Radio. Did you have any final comments?
Oh, look, I just think they call it estate renewal. I think estate renewal should be a people approach.
Yes.
Really.
Yeah.
And, yes, maintenance is an issue, so just if it's broken, fix it. Don't destroy it.
Absolutely. And they need to be maintaining the buildings anyway. Yeah. Yeah,
yeah.
Which they don't. Yes. Yeah. Well, I think we're sort of going to wrap up now, but thank you so much, Karen, for joining us. All the solidarity and well wishing from us down here in Naarm, and we hope to check in again with yourself and other members of the Fight to Save the Waterloo Public Housing
campaign. Please do.
Yeah, thank you. Have a beautiful day, and best of luck.
Okay, thank you. Bring a tent.
Yeah.
Okay, bye.
Thanks again, Karen. All right, we're just speaking to Karen Brown, who is a public housing tenant at one of the Waterloo estates, which has actually been stated for demolition by the state Labor government in New South Wales. Mm. Now, I thought for the next 5 minutes I'll actually play another song. So I was going to play a track by singer-songwriter Candice Alicia, and this is Goodnight Irene, that she performed for live for Touchgrass. And she's actually going to be performing for an upcoming Green Left fundraiser, which is going to be coming up soon. So that's going to be coming up on Saturday, June the 20th. And I hope listeners are able to come along to the fundraiser and hear her and some other great performers.
Yeah.
So that's going to be happening on Saturday, June the 20th from 6 p.m. at the Maritime Union of Australia. You're listening to Candice Alicia.
good night, Irene. You know your love was unclean. You were just a sweet dream in his eyes. You were far too young to decide. Mr. Robinson said you were pretty. We were tough.
All right, sorry for there was just a bit of internet issues with the streaming of that happening before. But yeah, you're just listening to Candice Alicia. And as mentioned before, she's going to be performing as part of a Green Left fundraiser that's going to be happening on Saturday, June the 20th. So I hope listeners are able to come along. And I mean, because in reality, it's going to be. It probably will be a bit of a fundraiser for Green Left Radio as well, because any sort of money raised for Green Left very much goes to helping keep our program on the air.
100%. But also, it's a great way of, experiencing some live music, and it's going to be a great, great day. So, yeah, come along. We're just going to go into the activist calendar now. So you are listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 8:55 a.m. So activist calendar. So tomorrow we have, lots of exciting events coming up, actually. Tomorrow there's a day gathering for What's Going On in Latin America. That one's over Zoom or at 10 p.m. or 2 p.m. in person at Ballum Ballum Place. That's at 15 Phoenix Street in Brunswick. Then there's a fun run for people who like to run, or you might have the option of walking as well. That's From the River to the Sea at 10 a.m. at Birrung Ma, Batman Avenue City. So all you runners out there, get along to that one. That's for a good cause. On Sunday this weekend, we have Naksa Day, the Great Ride of Return, 11 a.m. at Royal Parade and Park Street, Brunswick. And then after that, we have the rally at the State Library, and this is commemorating 59 years since the Naksa. And then we have another rally coming up for council. Oh, that's good that they're taking another action. Council workers deserve a pay rise. That's at 5:30 p.m. Wednesday, June the 10th, at the Mary Beck Civic Centre, 90 Bell Street, Coburg. There's Support Community Radio on 3CR. So it's the Radiothon special coming up next Friday. So make sure you tune in for that. That's 7 a.m. till 8:30 a.m. And you can tune in online or 8:55 a.m. on your dial. And you can donate online or call 9419 8377 if you'd like to support the great work that Green Left Radio and 3CR do, because 3CR is a fantastic radio station. We have a presentation coming up on Saturday, June the 13th, in person with Nick Hanna, 3 p.m. at Kino Cinema, 45 Collins Street. There's a fundraiser night for Cuba, 7 p.m. at the Retreat Hotel, Level 1, 280 Sydney Road, Brunswick. And then Wednesday the 17th, there's another webinar coming up, Profit from Punishment, Inside the Welfare Compliance Scandal. That sounds really interesting. 7 p.m. online. Friday, June the 19th, there's a film screening, Tantura, 6:15 p.m. at Cinema Nova, 380 Carlton, Ligon Street in Carlton. On Saturday, June the 20th, there's a fundraiser for Lebanon, 12 p.m. at Dakana, 99-101 Harding Street, Coburg. There's some other events coming up, including a panel. So this is all these other events are also on Saturday, June the 20th. There's a panel, Class Struggle for Indigenous Liberation, at 1 p.m. at Auntie Alma Thorpe's Gathering Place. That's 546 to 550 High Street, Preston. There's a rally on that same day. On World Refugees Day, Fight for Refugee Rights. That's at 2 p.m. at the State Library in the city. There's a book launch, Cold War Kids by Rowan Cahill, I think. Sorry, I probably butchered that. 3 p.m. at Ballum Ballum Place, again in Brunswick. There's also a fundraiser, Solidarity Forever, A Night of Cultural Dissent, 6 p.m. at the Maritime Union of Australia, and that's a fundraiser for Green Left. So make sure you come along to that one. That'd be great to have as many people as possible. Some other events coming up. There's a 3CR Community Day celebration. This is on the 4th of July, 50 Years on Air, and that will be at 11 a.m. Collingwood Town Hall, 140 Hoddle Street. That's going to be a really exciting day. We'll be there as well. The Green Left Radio team will be having a stall. And for more events, please head over to our website, greenleft.org.au/events. And we'd also strongly encourage people to sign up for email calendars, because depending on where you live, there'll be a special calendar that gets sent out to you every 2 weeks, and it's so useful to know what's going on in your own state, wherever you're tuning in from.
All right, well, Before we have our last and third live interview for the program, I thought I'll play another track from one of the artists who's going to be performing at our upcoming performance night, Les Thomas. And for the next 4 minutes, this is a song called An Anthem Against Genocide. Hope listeners enjoy. You're listening to Green Left Radio.
Out there on the firing line, see the faces left behind. Hiroshima by the day, torn and scattered where they lay on the firing line. Never again is what they said. Now I wonder what they meant. Did they speak for all of us? Lives unequal, gold or dust on the firing line. Fail in the incubation room, born into a world of doom on the firing line. There's no reason, no excuse, and no accepting their abuse. No time for complicity, but they've every reason to be free on the firing line. Justice turns to you.
Turns to.
What will you tell your own child? What's left of the meek and mild on the firing line? Don't be silent, please be brave.
All right, you're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. I'm just kidding. We now have our last and final live interview for the program this week. We're joined today by Jake Delphin, who is an educator based in Melbourne, who is actually part of organising an upcoming protest titled Who Controls Our Data, which is basically, you know, a rally that's encouraging public discussion around AI expansion, data infrastructure, and the importance of transparency, public consultation, and long-term planning, especially in the context of, you know, the fact that there's a big push for building these large data centres in Victoria. So good morning, Jake.
Hi, thanks for having me.
To kind of start off, just for our listeners, you know, this obviously been appearing in the news, and I know you appeared in Channel 9 kind of recently being interviewed about this. Can you give us a bit of an overview of this kind of push to build new data centres in Victoria, and what are some of the proposed locations?
Yeah, of course. So currently we're seeing a massive push, to be honest, across the West. It's basically a rapid expansion of data infrastructure, obviously as the demands for AI continue to grow. I would say these facilities are becoming critical infrastructure, really, because as AI continues to grow, they need more storage. My concern isn't necessarily that data centres exist. I'm well aware, like, we have quite a large number of them in Australia already. My concern mainly centres around the fact that expansion appears to be happening at a rate and, like, a scale that communities really aren't even fully aware of. And there really hasn't been enough public discussion or transparency around planning and long-term impacts of these centres. We have the one in Hazelwood that they're proposing, which is near Morwell, which is considered to be the biggest proposed site. There's one that they're proposing in Brooklyn in West Melbourne, and then Laverton North, as well as one in Port Melbourne, which is near me.
Hmm. Yeah, thanks for that, Jake. And I'm just noting as well that it's often in areas that are already industrial and already have, like, terrible air quality that they're building these data centres. Environmental groups have sounded the alarm on this push by arguing that the construction of these data centres has serious environmental risks. Are you able to speak to that?
Yeah, of course. I personally am not a massive environmentalist, but I do see the environmental issues associated with this issue. Mm-hmm. And I can say that there are a lot of people that I've spoken to within the community as well who have really taken issue with the energy and water consumption projections by these mm-hmm. data centres. Yeah. Not to mention we have noise issues. I've seen a lot of videos online of the noise associated with people living near the centres. And there's also a lot of concerns that the increased demand on electricity and the water infrastructure could, I mean, ultimately contribute to higher costs for consumers. I do think these concerns deserve serious public discussion and consultation from us, the people. Projects of this scale can't really just be judged on investment announcements. I feel like people want to understand the long-term costs and the benefits to us, if there are any at all.
Mm. Yeah, and you know, actually, just one point I sort of want to jump on that you sort of mentioned here, that, of course, I mean, one of the interesting things about this push to build new data centres has been the kind of rate at which new data centres are being kind of proposed. Because remember, you know, for the past decade, you know, we have used Google, we have used streaming services like Netflix, you know, we've used cloud computing, you know, we've used all these sort of these systems for quite a long time, actually. And all those services actually do require data centres, but it is a bit, I think there is a bit of an interesting shift to the fact that there's so many data centres being built, but it's very much linked by, you know, this big push by corporations to invest in generative artificial intelligence, which requires a lot more energy and a lot more data than any of the services that I've mentioned before previously used. And I guess, what are some of your comments, I guess, on this push? Because I think, there is a lot of scepticism that people do have about generative AI. But there's obviously a lot of different opinions and perspectives on it. But I guess I want to hear someone who's part of organising this rally, what are your kind of general thoughts on this push?
I personally think that they're setting up to build the digital infrastructure for... I think they need these data centres because... we're sitting on this precipice where AI is becoming such a big technology that we're using. And I think the eventual goal will be to, I mean, all countries across the West, we've got the UK, we've got New Zealand, we have Australia, we have Europe, we have America. They're all talking about a digital ID system in the future. And I definitely think they need this data infrastructure for that.
So you're kind of part of organising a community rally against these proposed kind of data centres on June the 13th. Can you tell us a bit about this protest? You can even tell us how it's sort of come together, who is kind of speaking on the platform, and I guess what are some of the demands of the protest?
So the rally is about creating public discussion. I've been following closely with what's happening in the US. I do think that there's so many people out there, especially young people, I feel like who are feeling a bit defeated by the government and especially with the recent budget that they've announced. And I think a lot of people think that there's no point in protesting or demanding answers and accountability as well. But I feel like it's our right as Australians to do it, especially as young people who are going to be affected, I think, the most by this. And I think we as Australians, I hope, would like transparency, strong assessment processes, meaningful consultations, and I feel like just a broader conversation around what kind of digital future Victoria and Australia want.
So can you tell us the details of the rally, just so some of our listeners might be able to come along?
Yep. So you can find the rally on Facebook. It's called Who Controls Our Data? Melbourne Community Rally. It's on Saturday the 13th of June at 11:30. It will be at the State Library, and we do have a couple speakers coming along. We're still confirming, but as of right now, we should have David Shoebridge, the Green Senator. We also have another lady who is currently running for state government with the Greens, who would like to speak. So we've got a couple different people that can provide a couple different viewpoints of the issue.
All right. Well, that sounds great. So yeah, we'll definitely promote the protest in our events calendar, because Green Left, which this program is associated with, very much tries to promote all the sort of different kind of protest events that have been kind of organised by the community. And also, we note that there is a bit of a group kind of emerging in the northern suburbs, because I think Broadmeadows Fordside is a site of artificial intelligence data centre. Do you have any kind of final comments you might want to end on?
Yeah, I would say, look, I feel like we're really at a precipice in society. I feel like we're really bordering on the edge of a technological revolution. I mean, with AI, the decisions that we make now will definitely shape decades of infrastructure and policy. I feel like you don't necessarily have to be anti-technology to ask questions. I'm certainly not. I actually use AI. But I just think people should feel comfortable asking questions about this stuff, especially if you don't know much, or just engaging in conversations surrounding this topic, because at the end of the day, it really does affect all of us.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Jake, for being on our program. And yeah, I'll just make a reminder to listeners, if you would like to attend this kind of protest, it's going to be at 11 a.m. Saturday, June the 13th. And thank you very much again, Jake, for being on our program.
Thanks for having me, and I hope to see people there if they're interested.
Thanks, Jake.
Okay, we're just speaking to Jake, a community member who's part of organising a protest against the sort of proposed sort of data centres. And one sort of observation, we've actually published quite a detailed interview in Green Left on artificial intelligence, because a lot of environment groups have actually done a lot of work on this stuff, because actually the amount of water that is kind of being used by these data centres is quite excessive in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And of course, the other issue as well is, there is very much not community consultation on the construction of these data centres. And also, I read an article recently, which kind of looked at some of the issues associated with this. But one of the issues as well is, you know, all these corporations are basically pushing governments to allow them to kind of build these data centres.
Yeah.
And there is a bit of this kind of false promise, which is basically, these data centres will bring jobs into the community. And actually, the reality is, I was sort of a bit perplexed by the fact that they're going to be building quite a massive one in Gippsland.
Yeah,
because, I mean, Gippsland, yeah, you know, they closed down all the coal pile.
Well, this is a new thing, Jake, but this is a new industry.
But I guess the point I sort of want to add is, in terms of what the research that has been sort of said about this, there's not actually that much jobs. There is some initial jobs. There's quite a lot of jobs in the initial stage of like for construction workers in terms of constructing the data center, et cetera. But, you know, that work only sort of lasts a year to 2 years, et cetera. Yeah. And the actual maintenance of the data centers actually only requires 30 to 50 people on average. Yeah. And of course, with generative AI, they maybe they'll realize that, oh, maybe we can actually cut even more jobs.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot to be kind of suspicious about in terms of this kind of push for generative AI, because I think under the sort of capitalist system, you know, generative AI is really just being used to displace work.
Yes.
And I think generative AI very much represents a big attack on the creative industries in particular.
Yes.
Like, you know, for my money, I mean, my honest kind of perspective is I have a certain tolerance for people who kind of use generative AI and like sort of the IT sort of fields, you know, the public sector, the private sort of, those sort of jobs. But I just think it's an outright attack on the creative industry. Like, it should not be used to replace things like acting, you know, artistic expression,
decision making
and so on. Like, you know, if generative AI makes something like a doctor's job slightly easier, like that's a different story from displacing work.
Well, potentially, but it's also, I mean, the impacts, I feel personally it's going to have a much bigger impact on job losses as a result of the services that AI enables than the jobs that will be created by a data centre, because, because this will go far into the future. But it's also, I mean, it's not just the arts either. Like, I mean, really critical decision making. Like, even, a lot of government services are leaning that way. And, like, I mean, we've seen just how, with things like the robo-debt awfulness that, you know, was just disastrous for people's mental health, with people receiving completely false Centrelink debt accusations and taking, you know, months and months to resolve. And, unfortunately it cost some people their lives because they were so desperate that they felt that was the only way out, which is terrible. AI, I mean, it's just a way of, to me, it's a way of further alienating the working class. I don't think it will bring people together or help us, function better as society. Like, it may save some time for things, but it has a lot of risk, and I don't think we've really across that.
I guess going into sort of the Marxist sort of perspective, I mean, I sort of feel that artificial intelligence sort of just represents the latest stage for, because capitalism is very much, the dynamic within capitalism is capitalism will always try and find more and more ways of, of increasing productivity within labor. They want to get more and more value out of labor by the hour.
Yeah.
I'm probably a bit more skeptical. I mean, of course, there's different perspectives within Marxist perspectives on this, but I'm a bit more skeptical about the idea that artificial intelligence will completely displace all work, because the nature of capitalism is capitalism does need labor to, and we've also done some previous programs actually from a more global South perspective, but actually artificial intelligence is actually creating job demand in sort of very low pay sort of industries, like sort of to be able to do the kind of work for creating the prompts, etc. Yeah. I mean, there was obviously that crazy story, I think I might have talked about how they had to employ workers in one African country to remove all the racism out of a particular artificial intelligence AI bot, chatbot. So, you know, there's work that is sort of being created by this, but also I think there's also another negative impact that this has is the impact of social media. I mean, social media has been obviously in a certain decline, but, you know, if you go on Facebook these days, you see a lot more kind of AI sort of generated sort of clickbait kind of nonsense. Yeah. And then there's also this, there's also the fact that Google now uses, you know, whenever you search Google, it sort of gives you an AI kind of result, which is having impact on certain industries that might have relied on Google for clicks, etc. So it's actually reducing the number of clicks that people have. So now there's all these complex dynamics that are sort of happening in the tech industry.
So many implications.
And then probably the worst, I mean, the biggest crime in all this, I know this is a bit of a joke here, but the biggest crime in all this is that it's very much driven up the price of consumer tech. So, you know, if you were to buy a gaming system, a laptop, any kind of computer, all those are going to get 30 to 50% more expensive in the next five to seven years because all these corporations are basically all buying up all the all the random access memory, which is driving up the price of memory. Like, I just think this is just ridiculous. Like, all these corporations are putting all this investment into artificial intelligence and yet we have no idea what it's actually going to be used for. And it's being pushed on us in a very undemocratic way, which I think, goes back to the point. I think this rally will be an interesting one to go to, especially in terms of raising those kind of questions.
100%. They're important conversations that need to be had. And that probably just brings us to the end of our program, I think, Jacob.
Yeah. So if you enjoyed the program War this week, I recommend you becoming a supporter of Green Left. You can become a supporter for as low as $5 or $10 a month.
Amazing value. Yeah.
And also suggest subscribing to 3CR. Next Friday, I'm pretty sure we're going to be having the special Radiothon program. Yes. So our Radiothon program will be a bit of an opportunity to reflect on the year ahead. We'll probably have a few listeners come in talking about why they support Green Left, but also 3CR in general. And I think you, for any of our listeners, consider making a donation to Green Left Radio as your kind of nominated sort of program. We have a target of around $1,500. I hope listeners enjoy. Come tune in next Friday from 7 a.m. to 8:30 for our Radiothon. You're listening to Green Left Radio.
This brings us to the end of the show. You have been listening to Friday Morning Breakfast with Green Left Radio, brought to you by Green Left Weekly Newspaper, which brings an alternative source of information that puts people and planet before profit.
If you like our work, become a supporter from $5 per month at greenleft.org.au/support or free call 1-800-634-206.
Arise, you workers from your slumbers. Arise, you prisoners of want. For reason in revolt now thunders, and at last ends the age of Khan. Away with all your superstitions, serve all masses,
arise!
We'll change henceforth the old tradition and spurn the dust to win the prize. That's right, the commies are back, reds underneath your beds and that crack.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.